Welcome to the Education and Empowerment Podcast. In this show, our hosts explore success and advancement through education by interviewing today's top leaders in the fields of education, business, and technology in order to provide insight into what it really takes to succeed. This show is brought to you by Forestay, a SaaS-enabled online booking marketplace for student and intern housing. Forestay provides turnkey, all-in-one, cloud-based accommodation software solutions for colleges, universities, and organizations. Learn more at offcampus.forestay.com and landlords.forestay.com. All right, let's get into the show.
You're listening to Education and Empowerment Podcast. I'm your host, Bakhtir Isoyev, and in this episode, I will try to inspire you to think about what the future is like for young people and how education leaders such as Dr. Gregory Washington, the president of George Mason University, continue to build the energy to build a bridge that connects young people from point A to point B. Dr. Gregory Washington leads the largest and most diverse public universities in Virginia, George Mason University. It's a Tier 1 research university, is categorized by the Carnegie Classification of Institutions of Higher Education. He became George Mason's 8th president in July of 2020. Dr. Gregory Washington was a former dean of the Henry Samueli School of Engineering at University of California, Irvine, former interim dean of College of Engineering at Ohio State University, and is regarded as a nationally as strategic and collaborative solution-oriented leaders who's committed to providing opportunities for students of all backgrounds. He is the first African-American dean of engineering at University of California campus. He's also a first African-American president at George Mason University. Dr. Gregory Washington established an Office of Access and Inclusion at University of California, Irvine, with purpose of enhancing campus life for all students, and chaired the task force on ensuring a positive climate for the campus's Black community. As a first-generation college graduate, Dr. Washington is a New York City native and attended high school in North Carolina. He earned bachelor's degree, master's degree, and his PhD, all in mechanical engineering at North Carolina State University. He's a member of the North Carolina State Engineering Foundation Board of Directors. All right, buckle up and be ready for a great dose of motivation and inspiration with an amazing leader, Dr. Gregory Washington, the president of George Mason University. Hello and welcome to Education and Empowerment Podcast. This is your host, Bakhtir Isoyev, and today I'm extremely happy and so thrilled to welcome to our podcast one of the inspirational leaders in Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. This is Dr. Gregory Washington, the president of George Mason University. Dr. Washington, there is so much about you, but I just want to get started. Welcome to our show.
Well, it is great to be here and great to talk with you.
Amazing. Thank you so much. So I think we want to start our podcast by getting to know you a little bit better. And if you don't mind letting us know how you got into higher education, what's your story?
My story is a really simple one. I got into school. I got into becoming an engineer because I used to do summer jobs in North Carolina on construction sites. And one year, it was in the middle of the summer, July weather, you know how the South is in the summertime. It was hot, you know, 95 degrees, 90 plus humidity, just hot.
Wow.
And I remember my job at the time was, you know, I would load bricks in a wheelbarrow, mix cement, carry the cement to the brick masons who would actually, you know, build the building, right?
Right.
And that's backbreaking work, right? That's, you know, you want a strong, scrappy kid out there just loading those brick, and we just did it all day, right? And there was a trailer on the site that every now and then a guy would come out in a hard hat. He would go talk to the brick masons and the carpenters and the folk working on the site. He would go talk with them. Then he'd go back in the building. And I asked the question, I said, who is that guy? I said, that's the engineer. I said, really? I said, that guy, the guy who sits in the AC while we're out here working and he comes out, checks on us and goes back in. I said, that's the engineer. He said, yeah. And then one of the brick masons told me something. He said, oh, and he makes all the money too. I said, so wait a minute. He makes all the money. He works in this air conditioned space. He comes out every now and then. And he does well too. And he's like, yeah. And I said, okay, maybe there's more to this engineering thing. So that's when I started thinking about becoming an engineer. And what got me into higher ed is that I'm now an engineering student, and we're having some challenges understanding our TAs. And it was because we had a number of TAs who had just come into the country. TAs are teaching assistants, right?
Right,
They help with the laboratories and the like, but they had just come to the US and they didn't speak very good English yet. And these were the guys who were running our labs, and we as students couldn't understand them. We struggled with it big time. And so a group of us went to the dean to say, hey, there's a problem here. We got to fix this. And I remember walking out of the dean's office and him tapping me on the shoulder and pulling me back in. And I said, oh, my God, I am getting ready to get kicked out of school. Long story short, he said, look, we're having a problem getting more Americans to be graduate students and to go on to graduate school. And you should think about that. Your grades are good enough. And I make a promise to you now that if you go to graduate school, if you go to graduate school at NC State, you will never have to pay a dime to go to school. In fact, I'm going to pay you.
Oh, wow.
And I just thought that was a great offer at the time. Now, little did I know, nobody pays to go to graduate school in engineering if you're working on a PhD, right? But I didn't know it then. It's like a great offer to me. And so that got me into graduate school. And amazing. Once I got into graduate school, I set my sights on being a professor. That's how I kind of got into the academy.
That's amazing. I mean, your story is definitely of inspiration because, you know, little do we understand about ourselves, when is the right time to ask a question about challenging us? And I'm glad you had that experience to challenge yourself, say, I want to be like them, right? And I'm sure there are so many young people who, you know, ask the same question. Walk us through how you ended up at George Mason University. I know that, you know, you came in as the 8th president, and it was during the time, you know, the world was facing a lot of uncertainty and obviously the global pandemic. Our podcast listeners would definitely be interested in knowing what's it like for you, right? Like it was a hard decision, I'm sure. I mean, George Mason is one of the strongest institutions in the nation, and would be curious to know what your, you know, journey was.
To be honest with you, I made the decision before the shut. And I always ask myself, if I had been offered the job after the country had shut down, would I have actually have taken it? And I'm not sure that the answer to that question is yes. I'm just not sure. I was the dean of the engineering school at UC Irvine. Things were going extraordinarily well. You know, I had the highest 2 or 3 years in a row of raising funds there. You know, we built 2 buildings and got lots of resources coming into the institution. I mean, just doing extraordinarily. Right. And you know, it was in Irvine, California, which is 30 miles outside of L.A. The weather is absolutely perfect. So there are lots of reasons to stay.
Right.
But I had been doing the dean of engineering job by that time, almost 11 years, going on 12. And I really felt that personally, I needed another challenge. So I started looking at other opportunities, and the Mason opportunity for me was a really good one in that it dealt with and engaged the kind of students that I wanted to support, right? I believe that the mission of George Mason's mission of reaching the masses and educating them and providing opportunity to those students who won't necessarily get it from other places, that was something I wanted to be a part of. And to be able to do it from the perch of an R1 institution,
right?
All of that was extraordinarily attractive to me. And so that is why I interviewed for the job. The individuals who nominated me, who asked me to pursue this, job all had, you know, all were familiar with the work I was doing in California. And they looked at Mason and they say, you know, what you're doing there is very similar to what George Mason does. I think there's a good match here. And it just, when you hear something three or four times, you investigate, right? That's kind of how it worked. And so I did. And sure enough, there were a lot of things that made a lot of sense here, right? I felt kind of like I felt when I met my spouse, right? There was a lot of things that there were big rocks we had in common. The real big things that were important to her were important to me. And that made it work. And it was the same thing with Mason. And so I actually chose the job in February. So, wow. You know, in February, the country had not shut down yet, right? And so I choose this job. I'm going to take it in February. And, you know, we get to mid-March. And by the time we get to mid-March, everything is shut down. And, wow. And I'm the president of this now shut down largest university in the state of Virginia. And so at that point, it was like, okay, how are we going to move this forward and meet our mission? You know, then I became very attuned to the needs of our students and our faculty and staff, because my philosophy was, if the country's struggling, then the people who we serve are probably really struggling.
Right.
They're really going to need an institution to help them matriculate. They're really going to need an institution to help them get a degree. They're really going to need an institution to upskill and reskill and retrain them, right? Because those are all the kinds of things that were going to be needed on the back end of the pandemic. And so I just jumped in with 2 feet, man.
That's amazing.
You know, and it's been a magnificent ride, to be honest with you.
Yeah. And I can echo that. I mean, I'm in the area and I speak with a lot of George Mason University students, your faculty, staff, you know, administration are some of the most amazing individuals. And that's definitely, you know, great to hear. And congratulations. I think most of the leaders that I speak with found themselves in exactly the same shoes of trying to navigate a lot of uncertainty. And I think you pointed this out correctly, that if the nation is struggling, then people and the students and the young people are struggling much more. For a moment, can you, you know, throw back to, you know, 2020 March? I mean, I believe you were still with the school there in California, and it was your transition to this role. What would you say are the biggest lessons we learned as educational leaders that's important for us today and that are going to be important, you know, as we move forward? What are those key three lessons learned or the takeaways, you would say?
Well, look, I can tell you that in the early days of the pandemic, it was really, you know, there were big lessons. And the big lessons dealt with, how do you manage and deal with uncertainty? How do you deal with something that no one who's in your sphere of influence, none of your mentors have the solution to, right? So, you know, I have higher ed mentors, people who have been presidents, chancellors for great universities throughout our country. And I started reaching out to them and saying, look, even back when I was the dean of the engineering school, I'm like, how do I handle this? Because we were dealing with the pandemic there. So what do we do? How do I handle it? What kind of decisions? And everybody said the same thing. I don't know. We don't know how to handle this. And so for me, I began to educate myself as much as possible, you know, the pandemic and the issues that were associated with it. And then I kind of just started to rely on the previous education that I had been given, right? You don't run away from change, you embrace it.
Exactly.
You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You rise to the occasion of the challenge.
That's true.
You get what I'm saying? Look, your intellectual curiosity determines your success, right? Sure. So these are the teachings that I kind of just said, okay, let me ground myself in who I am, what I've been exposed to, and then let's see how we're going to tackle this problem. And as I began to gain information, we began to put together, look, even when I had already accepted the job at Mason and I was transitioning from Irvine, I mean, my nights and weekends was all spent developing a construct. Actually, you can say my early mornings and late evenings, right? Because there's a 3-hour time difference from California to here. And that meant for 3 hours or so, I literally could start working on the challenges that we were going to see here at Mason. and then, you know, do my day job there in California.
Wow.
And then that night and evening, I was back doing this other thing. So I was able to really get a handle, a decent handle on the place and get an understanding. But to kind of give you the short answer to your question, it was really about trying to figure out what was most important, what were the critical things that I needed to do and I needed to put in place, and basically executing on that until I can walk in the door and actually, you know, make things happen on campus.
Yeah, now that's truly is of you know, a huge inspiration to me and to other people that I was talking to. You know, George Mason University, you know, was one of the first ones to actually set up the clinics, you know, for people mm-hmm. to get vaccinated. There are a number of programs like, you know, the Mason Promise and, you know, the Advanced Program, the Institute yep. of Digital Innovation, you know, a lot of the different promising programs, initiatives, you know, were in place to, you know, help move the needle forward, so to speak. But I think what's more important is, what's the future like, right? Like, how do we now prepare young people for an economy that is, in some literature now, is referred to post-pandemic? I don't know if I agree with that, because I don't know if we ever exited or ever will, but hopefully we will. But, you know, the pre-pandemic economy was quite different, right? I mean,
yeah.
You know, the needs were different.
Well, look, I'll tell you this. And in all honesty, this time is now different from when, you know, if I go back to March of 2020 and July of 2020, when I started then. And it's different because we remember back then we didn't have vaccines.
Right.
In March, April, May, you know, we got some later on that summer, but there were no vaccines. We didn't know how well they were going to work. You had a lot of death associated. There was so much misinformation relative to the virus and how it was being transmitted. And so you had all of these issues.
Right.
Right. Now we kind of know how the virus is transmitted. We know what works and what doesn't work. We're better able to protect, even though we're dealing with a lot of death and hospitalization still, we have tools now. And if yes. you take those tools and utilize them, you can come out of the back end of this and be in decent shape, right?
Right.
So to me, that would be the development of these tools and the implementation of these tools really, to me, kind of demarcate a post-pandemic framework. Doesn't mean that COVID hadn't gone away.
Right.
I think it's going to be with us for quite some
time. Right.
We were literally brought to a standstill.
Yes.
Right? Nothing was happening. I went back and I saw some video of different cities and the streets. They were literally deserted, right? It was like a scene from a horror movie, right? We're clearly not there now, right? Right. So the decision now is, how do we manage and deal with using the tools we have with the actual virus that we are dealing with, right? That to me is what the post-pandemic future actually looks like. And one of the things I grew to realize very quickly is that it's not just the pandemic
exactly.
that we're dealing with. Our students today are dealing with unprecedented change, right? It took radio 38 years to get to 50 million users. And then all these students are playing Fortnite now. It took Fortnite 2 weeks to get to 50 million users, right? So you see that level of change, and it's happened over a continuum, right? As you went from the radio to the television to the cell phone to the internet to Facebook and all that, the time just shrinks literally geometrically, and so change is happening at a much faster pace now than it has ever happened. Exactly. They're dealing with unprecedented challenges. So you don't just have the pandemic, but we have climate. That's a challenge. Our changing and our climate is an issue. You know, this past summer, it's right. not too far since the summer, but Portland reached 115 degrees this summer. Portland, Oregon.
Wow.
In British Columbia and Canada, it's 118 degrees. Seattle was, and not just for one day, over a stretch of days, right? In British Columbia, the temperature got so hot that the shellfish popped open.
Wow.
At the ocean. They literally just popped open. And that means that they were cooked, right? That's how we know when it's time to eat them, and they pop open. That's what's happened this summer, right? And so we're seeing these real challenges in front of our students. They're dealing with more autocracies in the world than democracies.
Right.
For the first time in at least 50 years. And it's not just that we have more autocracies than democracies, is that there is now a legitimate debate on whether autocracies are better for people than democracies, right? This is a legitimate debate that people are having. And it's one in which we should have. Look, so my philosophy is higher ed is needed now more than it has ever been needed in easily the last 50 years. We are at a point where we have left our students, we had left our youth with tremendous challenges, challenges that are unprecedented since going back to the very challenges that the last great generation had to deal with and solve. What's in front of the youth of today is akin to that level of challenge. And what I take seriously is that it is my job. It's our job. That's why I'm doing this podcast, right? This is why we engage. It's our job to use all of the tools that we have at our disposal to A, help them to realize that they're in a for a fight, and B, to give them as many tools and education as we can in order for them to prepare themselves for the battle that's ahead. Because it will be a significant one, and it will last until their lifetime. And look, I'm not being totally altruistic here. I have two college-age sons, and the reality is that they're going to have to take care of me, right? Sure. And so if they got to take care of me, guess who's going to be a genius when they grow up, right? They're going to know everything they need to know because I got to get taken care of. Sure. And I don't think we think about that way as, you know, adults, as people who are in their middle ages, who are, you know, winding down on the backside of their careers. I don't think we think about the fact that the people we're educating today are the ones who are going to inherit what we give them, and they're going to be responsible for making sure that we actually can live a reasonable life in our older age. And if we thought about that and really internalize it, I think we would be making very different decisions in our society relative to, you know, how we should, what we should give our students and what positions we should be putting them.
You're so right. And, you know, one of the, not concerns, but, you know, one of the voices I've been hearing, you know, through young people is, well, you know, what is the job economy going to look like? You know, will there be need for the four-year degrees, or, you know, should I better stick with something short? I know with, you know, your institution, it's, you know, you're more into the research, but what would you say is the future like for, you know, what kind of, if your own kids were interested in, you know, going to this, I don't know, a different job, like, what would you say to them? And what would you address to your students?
I have these discussions with my kid. And look, what I tell them is this: no matter what you choose in life, no matter what direction you choose to go, you need to have some basic understanding of coding and software.
Yeah.
Why? Because everything is essentially a computer with hardware wrapped around it, right? Your car is a computer on wheels. You open your refrigerator, it's an ice box with it's a computer with an ice box around it, right? You use your washer and dryer. Your washer and dryer is an entity for washing clothes. That's a computer, right? Everything, right? The watch that you wear on your wrist nowadays, it's a computer that tells time, right? And so understanding, even if you're an artist, right? At some point in time, you're going to have to deal with the digital world, even to get paid. Now, artists are now getting paid through these non-fungible tokens, these NFTs, right? And guess what? NFTs means that you need to know a little something about coding, right? And so no matter what you do, you got to have some basic understanding of the coded world and how it works. And so I encourage all students, no matter from what walk of life, is get a basic understanding of software and coding. And the great thing is you don't have to take a class at, you know, and get a computer science degree nowadays in order to do that. There are lots of short courses. There are lots of things you can get into, even here at Mason, through our continuing ed programs that gives you a basic understanding. You, to me, you are a much more marketable person if you have the basic understanding of coding, no matter what your basic job classification is, than if you don't.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. I'd be willing to bet you that the you're speaking to me in this great equipment that you're using to conduct this podcast,
yep,
right, is basically computerized.
Exactly. You're so right. In alignment to that, what would you say are the programs or initiatives at George Mason that you're particularly proud of? Can you elaborate on George Mason's accomplishments since your presidency or since its existence?
I tell you, I believe that the mission of George Mason is the most consequential and the most important of all institutions in our state. And look, we have great institutions in our state. I'm not taking anything away from them. What I am saying is that the mission of this institution is a special one, and it is not the same as the mission of many others. And the reality is this. Look, this year I put in place what's called the Mason, Virginia Promise. Mm-hmm. And what is that? It's a promise of an advanced degree or your own business for every Virginian that wants it.
It's amazing.
Okay. No other institution can make that claim in the state and be credible. Right. We have institutions that are much more elite.
Right.
Right. Than Mason. Well, the problem is that for every 10 people that apply, only 2 to 3 get in.
Right.
Right. So you can't be the institution for everyone in the state with an admit rate that low. Right. 70% of the students can't get into the school. Right? That's one. Two. So we want to offer your degree. So we will help you to get a degree, or we'll help you to start your own business. There are 27 small business development centers in the state of Virginia. Mason manages all of them.
Wow.
So if we can't help you, let's decide you say, I don't want to go to school. I don't want to get a degree. I have a skill. I'm a carpenter. I want to start my own carpentry business. You can go to our SBDC. We can help you there. Again, there's no other institution with that mission. Not a single one in our state. You see where I'm going here?
Absolutely.
So the idea is we are best positioned to meet you where you are, right? And I say that we're the ultimate point B institution. And what does that mean? We will get you from point A to point B. You determine what point B is, and it doesn't matter where point A is, right? Half of the institutions in our state, point A matters. If you don't have the right grades, if you didn't do as well as you needed to do on this exam, if you didn't have this kind of additional extracurricular activities, you can't get in our institution. Mason's not like that. Right. You get what I'm saying? Doesn't matter where point A is. Like I said, even if you decide you don't want to go to school, this institution can actually engage with you and support you. Now, what I would tell everyone is you may not get a degree, but you have to have some level of education to exist and to operate in our society today. You got to be willing to learn something about whatever craft or trade you want to get into. You got to know how to make it work as a business. You got to know how to take the latest and greatest technology. Like I said, technology is everywhere. Many of the tools that are being used today have a technology related benefit attached to them, where you can get additional throughput. So you will always be learning in the society of the future. You always have to set yourself up, say, look, I may not want a degree, but I'm never going to give up on learning. I'm never going to give up on new knowledge. I'm going to go out and get that kind of thing And we want to be the institution that helps you do that. And I contend to you that Mason has always positioned itself to be that institution. And what really got me thinking about it was in my early days when I accepted the job and I was doing my onboarding, I was meeting with my alum, I was meeting with different individuals in industry, some of which who had George Mason degrees.
Right.
I met a donor who had become fairly wealthy. He'd done really well for himself. And he was a Mason grad. And so I come to him and we're talking and I say, hey, tell me about your undergraduate and your graduate. He said, okay. He said, I didn't get an undergraduate degree. Mm-hmm. And I got my master's and I got my MBA from George Mason. I said, what do you mean you didn't get an undergraduate? He said, I didn't get a degree. He said, well, now when I came to Mason, I had had some classes at another university in Virginia. I'm not going to mention the name.
Right.
But I didn't graduate. And I had all of this work experience. I had done some great things on the job, but I didn't have a degree. And they were able to look at my work experience and cobble together mm-hmm. enough stuff
right.
to get me admitted into this master's program. So he got admitted into the master's program without a degree. And then he got his MBA. And from there, he was able to take off. His business exploded. He just did extraordinarily well. Right. And so I'm listening to this. And the whole time I'm saying to myself, oh, my goodness, I've never heard of someone getting a bachelor's, getting a master's degree without a bachelor's. This is a special place. There are some things that you can do here that you couldn't do elsewhere. I'm going to expand that. I'm not going to say, oh, we did it the wrong way. This is not the kind of thing that our academic institution should be doing. We should look more like Harvard and Yale. No, actually, this is what our future needs, right? Right now, a little more than 50% of the graduate, you know, adult age people in our state are educated, meaning that they have a 2-year or 4-year degree. Right. That number needs to be well over 75% if we're going to have a truly educated populace in this state, right?
Yep.
The only way to get there is to have institutions like Mason.
And you've given an absolutely amazing example of the B institution that you were referring to. Meeting the donor, you realized where his A is and help him to get to B. And I think that was like the fantastic example that you just brought.
Well, and I'll tell you one other thing about this. This guy was a donor.
Right.
Right. And you ask, well, why is he a donor? Because he actually recognized the influence.
Exactly.
He recognized the power that Mason had in terms of helping him.
Right.
The reason for his achievement in life and positioning him to do these great things that he did in industry
exactly.
was because he actually went and got that additional degree and that he had a degree from an institution like Mason.
Yep.
And I know that as people are out there and they're listening to this podcast, many of them will be Mason graduates. It could be graduates of any institution. The institutions today, many of them in this state are severely underfunded, George Mason being amongst the worst. And so we need those donations, right? Engage. If it's not here, engage with whoever that local institution is that you graduated from, because that's a big part of the post-pandemic future as well. We have to be prepared to help and support people in this regard.
That's amazing. And, you know, one of the things that definitely stand out that I really like is the whole technology aspect of things. You know, with technology, you are able to scale. With technology, you decrease the speed by which in the past things were accomplished, right? And so, you know, in my current engagement, I speak with a lot of leaders such as yourself about the importance of technology. You know, our company, First Day, provides on and off campus housing solutions. And most of the transformation that happens is because of that technology. So I totally agree with you on those points. And I think, you know, as we kind of start to, you know, wrap up our episode, I was hoping that you could elaborate about, you know, what the future is like. And you mentioned that, you know, when you were coming, it was important for you to also identify that A point, right? Like where where can we meet them and how can we take them to like the next level? And I'm sure other leaders and educators and education entrepreneurs and the solution providers who are working to provide those tools that you mentioned are curious to know how can they identify those, you know, A points, right? So would you kindly address the needs of those who are also going through these challenges, whether it be a, you know, VP or president or education executive? Right. What would you say is the future like for them and what should they do?
So this whole idea of change is real.
Yeah.
And that's the only thing that is constant, and that there will be dramatic change. And what that change means to me and to many others who study this is that, look, you're going to have a much greater need for education that is in alignment with whatever direction your company, your business, or your field is going.
Right.
Okay. So what do I mean when I say that? Look, we are now creating more knowledge. We've created more knowledge over this last year than we had between 2016 and the beginning of time as we know it.
Exactly.
So if you take all the accumulated knowledge that you have all the way up to 2016, right? And then you look at what happened just during the pandemic year. Mm-hmm. We have created that much in terms of information, right. And that information is changing the way in which we do businesses. We now know that most of what undergraduates learn will literally be obsolete by the time they graduate. And so really it's the ability to think and to think critically that's important. And so some of the basic skills that's needed in your particular job, no matter what it is you're doing, or the basic skills in which, you know, so if I'm a baseline engineer, and I hire people and they work on a particular software, chances are that software will change multiple times throughout their career. And as that person moves up the leadership, you know, ladder, they will be supervising people who are using tools that the individuals in those leadership positions have no idea how they work, right? What I'm telling you is that over time, that lack of knowledge becomes problematic as they, you know, as more and more of the tools, as the tools become more and more complex that the individuals are utilizing. Mm-hmm. So for those individuals, they may have to go back. They don't have to go back and learn the details of the tool, but they need to know enough to be able to supervise the individuals that are under them, right? Mm-hmm. And so those are for the people in leadership. If you're a line level person, a staff person, you're working in an organization, you're probably already seeing that your job is changing, right? Right now, automation can already, currently, can replace 47% of our current workforce.
Wow.
And that it could be automation in terms of sorting and packing and moving goods and services, but it can also be digital automation in terms of computers answering the phone and engaging with people. You probably notice this now when you get on and look, I'm just as bad as everybody else. I hate talking to a computer when I get on the phone, right? Because the technology is not all the way there. Mm-hmm. But every now and then you get on the phone with a company and they have a computer and the computer gets you. Mm-hmm. It understands you. You say what it is you want to do and it says, okay, I'm going to route you to this person, I'm gonna write you that person. Like, uh-oh. That's when you start to say, okay, it's coming along, they're getting it. And at some point in time, that computer will be able to be very, very efficient in terms of engaging you and answer. Well, what happens to all of the people who were doing those jobs previously?
Exactly.
All of those folks, they have to go out and find there are other jobs out there for them, right? They have to go out and find those jobs. And I contend to you, the country has always been that way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? When Henry Ford was looking, when he had designed his first vehicle, and he went out in the community and started talking to people about what were their needs, they all told them they needed a faster horse. Right? We need a faster horse.
Right.
Right. And so the automobile didn't look like a horse. Mm-hmm. Right. And the individuals who made horseshoes probably went out of business. Right. Yeah. The individuals who made saddles probably went out. The carriages that the horses pulled, a lot of them, they went out of business. Some mm-hmm. of them, the carriage producers, actually produce automobiles. Mm-hmm. Right. Some of them made the transition to produce things instead of doing, you know, the shoes for the horses. You started developing tires. Exactly. for the automobile. You get what I'm saying here, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
That's the same thing that has to happen now. As we move to this digital economy, yeah. people are going to have to shift. Okay, so what are we doing at Mason? We are putting in place short courses, mm-hmm. Certificate programs. You can get in less than, you know, 3 to 6 months, right? Yep. In the areas that are in highest need, in areas that are growing. So we actually have a program. We've identified here are the top 10 areas that are needed in Northern Virginia. Here are where the jobs are. That's how we know what are the top 10. We mm-hmm. literally looked at the job postings. And from that, we say, here are all the opportunities, right? Let's develop short courses around those, because we know it doesn't make sense for somebody to go out and get a degree, have to go 4 years and get it. People don't have that kind of time. And plus, they got to make money. Yep. But the idea here is, you can do this in your own leisure. You can do this over time. And, you know, and if you do it full time, you can do it in, you know, 6 months.
Exactly.
And guess what? Now you're positioned to go into the marketplace with skills that are being requested by companies looking for people with jobs. Look, we have right now somewhere in the neighborhood of about, yeah, depending on what study you look at, between 4 and 6 million unemployed people.
Wow.
And we got between 9 and 12 million job openings, right?
That's
why can't that 4 to 6 million just jump into those other jobs? Because they don't have the prerequisite skills for those jobs. Mm. But guess what? If we can be that bridge to provide them that gap, they can jump into those jobs. That's another big task that we're trying to solve currently.
That's a beautiful summary to, you know, our conversation. And what really stuck, you know, here is the fact that 47% that you mentioned, that's kind of, you know, reduced by the automation, is the exact same population that could be bridged into the programs that George Mason is, you know, very famous for, to prepare them for the future of post-pandemic economy. And you are one amazing inspirational leader that I will personally continue to admire and continue to see all the different growth that you're bringing to this institution and to the Northern Virginia area and to Virginia and the nation.
Well, I thank you very much, Becky, and I look forward to engaging with you in the future.
That's amazing. Is there a piece of advice, wisdom, or any quote on, you know, education or empowerment that you'd like to leave us with before you go?
Look, when I talk to my students and my faculty here, I give them one piece of advice. And ever since the pandemic has started, it's been the same. And that is to stay safe. You need to do the kinds of things that you need to do in order to, look, if we don't have health, none of the other stuff matters, right? If you're not well, everything else stops, right?
Exactly.
So do what you can right now to stay safe, mm-hmm. and do what you can right now to keep learning.
That's a beautiful quote. Thank you so much, Dr. Gregory Washington. I really enjoyed learning from you, and I'm sure that our podcast listeners will do as well. Your leadership, as I said, is very inspirational. Thank you for all the contributions you're making. For our podcast, please subscribe to podcast.forestay.com to continue getting inspirational and empowering episodes from educational leaders in the nation. And until our next show, thank you so much.
Thank you. Look forward to engaging you in the future.
Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Education and Empowerment Podcast. This show is brought to you by Forestay, a SaaS-enabled online booking marketplace for student and intern housing. Forestay provides turnkey, all-in-one, cloud-based accommodation software solutions for colleges, universities, and organizations. Learn more at offcampus.forestay.com and landlords.forestay.com.